Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And while it doesn't really feel like it outside at the moment, spring is coming, and spring is kind of here, and bats are coming out of hibernation. On the show today, we're going into Wisconsin's bat caves to kind of check out on those flying mammals. And a couple of guests to help you out with that task. We're going to talk about our state's population of bats with our guests from the Wisconsin DNR, Jennifer Riddell, back with us. Been a while. Bat biologist and a cave and mine specialist. Jennifer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Paul White, our other guest. Paul's a mammal ecologist, and he specializes in bats and white nose syndrome. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Great to have you with us. So as we talk about bats, I hope you'll join in. Have you? What types of bats have you spotted? What do you think will help the bat population recover? Want to hear from you. With your questions or comments, the number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. How's the bat population doing here in the state, just to start things out? Paul, do you want to take that?
Sure. So, you know, we're 9 years removed from white nose syndrome first showing up in the state in 2014. And so during those initial years, during this epidemic from white nose syndrome, we had noticed populations dramatically reduced to where caves and mines were in many cases void of bats. So the cave hibernating bat species that we have four in the state. And unfortunately, white nose syndrome, which is a disease that affects hibernating bats caused by an invasive fungus, it thrives in these cold and dark and damp locations. Obviously, it grows. The fungus can grow on the nose itself, which obviously where the name comes from, but it will attack other exposed skin membranes as well, which include wings. And wings are incredibly important, not only for flight, but for thermal regulation and such. And so the years since now 9 years removed, we're actually starting to see somewhat of a stabilization in population. But that's not to say we haven't lost a large portion of our bats, bat population. Little brown bats, which was, you know, once one of the most ubiquitous bat species across the state, we've lost nearly 70% of those species across the state. Northern long-eared bat, 99% reduction in population. And eastern pipistrel, or also known as a tricolored bat, we've seen their populations decline more than 90%. But again, that's not all to say that there's bad news. I think that there is good news on the way. They are somehow surviving white nose syndrome. They're choosing sites that they're able to persist and tolerate this fungus. And so we're excited to continue to monitor these sites.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer, you're a cave and a mine specialist with the DNR. Maybe you could take us into a bat cave a little bit. Where are they typically found, those that are left? Where are they found in the state?
Yeah, we have about 250 hibernation sites in our state of Wisconsin, and we think we've done a pretty thorough job looking for all of them prior to this disease arriving in 2014. We wanted to make sure we established our baseline data on hibernating bat populations. So about 250 sites, approximately half of those are man-made or human-made mines and other similar structures like tunnels and even root cellars. And then about half of those sites are caves, and most of those sites are located in the southwest portion of the state. But, of course, we also have some cave and karst landscapes leading up into Door County and along the eastern edge of the state. So in wintertime, that's where our bats go, and they're going into these sites, actually arriving in late August. You know, they spend all summer gorging themselves on insects, trying to build up their fat reserves, and then by the end of August, traveling to the hibernation site and spending time there in the nights throughout September, swarming or flying around the cave and mine entrances with other bats, and that's their mating period. They're getting ready to go into hibernation, and then around October 1st, they're choosing a spot where they're going to kind of descend into longer periods of torpor inside the cave that's usually on the ceiling or the wall, somewhere out of reach of predators. And they're selecting that cave environment because it's dark, it's undisturbed, hopefully. And so it's also very high in humidity, and it's a constant temperature, hopefully of somewhere between 45 and 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And so they'll settle into torpor, lower their temperature, body temperature to around ambient temperature, slow their heart rate and their breathing. So their heart may only beat a few times every few minutes. They may take a breath only once every 10 or 12 minutes. And all of that is a strategy to conserve energy, because they're going to spend 6 or 7 months in some cases underground using that critical cave habitat to hibernate. And then, you know, this coming week and the last couple of weeks are when finally we see bats starting to emerge from those overwintering caves and mines back up here onto the landscape. So our nights are just starting to warm up, and as soon as we see the nighttime temperatures routinely get above 50 degrees is when we really start to see our little brown bats in particular coming up onto the landscape.
How do they hang? Is there a lot? I mean, you know, they're sleeping, but they're hanging. What is there some sort of locking mechanism that gets involved there?
Yeah, they've got these, you know, super fine and sharp little toenails, number one. But then they do have a special tendon in their foot that keeps their foot closed in that locked gripping position. So that's how they're able to hang on without thinking about it.
Hmm. And so I'm wondering, and maybe, Paul, you can talk about this. All right, we monitor the population. We watch the population go down. Someone might ask, what's the purpose of, why is it important to monitor the bat population?
Well, we know bats are fascinating animals. They're vital for a healthy environment. They eat tons of insects, as Jennifer had already alluded to, which benefits not only us as humans, but also our crops and our forests as well. They're incredibly economically important, valuable. Some research suggests that bats could save the agricultural industry more than $3 billion in pest control services every year by simply eating insects. So there are plenty of reasons to like bats, but you just have to find which one makes the most sense to you.
And in terms of monitoring, what's the process? You don't want to really disturb the bats.
Right. So, just like Jennifer was mentioning, the cave and mine surveys are done by specific personnel in the department. These trips are very coordinated. They're in and out very quickly. But when they're on the above ground, we have actually two citizen-based monitoring programs that help capture the activity that's happening in the landscape, whether that's monitoring a bat house in somebody's backyard or at a state park, counting bats as they emerge, and then helping us develop a picture of the local population, but also, you know, aggregating all that together statewide to understand the statewide picture. But we also have acoustic bat detectors that are stationed throughout the state, which allow folks to eavesdrop on bats as they echolocate forage in the night sky. And that gives us a relative abundance, but also an idea of where species are located throughout the state.
Clara Nyport, who produced the show, shot me a couple of places to look at. I was to look at what the DNR has, and I hadn't been there in a while, but one of the photos was looked like a box with a bunch of different levels in it, and it was kind of full of bats.
Yeah, that's a maternity colony. So those bat houses can keep 50 to 150 bats per chamber if it's a single chamber house. And oftentimes we'll put multiple roosting baffles up inside the bat house, and the bats really like to cram themselves up in there. And that's, again, just for summer months, and it's primarily the females using those bat houses. They like to be cozy and warm because that's where they're having their pups, their babies. Each mother bat has usually one pup or baby per season. And, of course, she leaves that pup behind for the first several weeks of its life before it's old enough to fly. So it's got to stay up in the bat house and stay warm during the night.
We'll take some calls. And again, you can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Russ in Belleville, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. I've got a question. I'm wondering, which bat species will use those bat boxes that people can install? And when and how or where should you install them to try to ensure success that you'll actually be able to have a colony of bats to help out?
That's a great question. We usually get two calls. One is folks trying to get bats out of their home, and then one is folks trying to get bats into a bat house like this. And so not all bat houses are created equal. Ideally, the perfect scenario is a bat house that is pretty large. So typically larger than maybe you'd find at a home department store or something like that, or a hardware store. So think 20 inches wide by 2 feet long. We have a variety of plans on our website. If you just Google Wisconsin Bat Program, on the lower left-hand corner, there'll be a document that shows a couple of different designs. And it's just like Jennifer mentioned, you've got baffles that are offset 3/4 of an inch. It's generally painted black. It's usually made of wood or weather-resistant materials like cedar or black locust. And you're building these airtight and watertight, so to ensure that the animals inside are going to stay warm, but also away from the elements. And you want to put these bat houses up. It could be either on the side of a building, so for example, a home. It could also be on the side of a garage, or even on a pole, say offset from a field edge, maybe 30 or 40 feet. And typically, we want them anywhere from 10 to 20 feet high. In somewhere in good sunlight where you can get 6 to 8 hours of sunlight a day.
And we'll talk some more about that with both of our guests, Paul White and Jennifer Riddell from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with Jennifer and Paul. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at Wisconsin's bat population on the show with a couple of guests from the Department of Natural Resources, talking with Paul White, who's a mammal ecologist for the DNR, Jennifer Riddell, a bat biologist and cave and mine specialist for the DNR. So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in with your questions. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And just as we were breaking for news, we had someone who called with a question about bat houses and also which species use them, and I'm not sure we answered that part of the question. I know you did mention, Paul, that there are plans for building a bat house on the DNR website, but what population of bats will use those houses?
Sure. Big brown bats and little brown bats are primarily the two species that we would expect to find in these bat houses.
Yeah. And Tim from Viroqua wondered, I mean, is it worth it to build bat houses or bat boxes around, your house or near your house? Jennifer, is it a good idea?
Yes, always a good idea. And, you know, your chances of success are highest if you're within about 1/2 mile or 1/4 mile of a drinking water source. And that means something wide enough, still enough water that a bat can swoop down and actually drink on the fly. So when they first wake up in the evening and drop out of that bat house and fly away, what they're doing is going to get a drink of water at a pond or a lake or a river, and then they're probably going to stay around for a couple of hours near that water body because obviously we have more insects available for foraging in those areas. So putting up a bat house is always a good idea. Paul mentioned, not putting it on a tree, getting it at least 8 or 12 feet off the ground if possible and facing full sun. And then, you may or may not get bats. It may take several years I can tell you I've got 3 bat houses, one on different sides of my house here in Madison, and I'm pretty close to water. I'm within a quarter mile of the lake. And I routinely have 1 or 2 big brown bats using my 3 bat houses. And I've had the houses up for 10 years. And that's all I've gotten, and I'm a bat biologist. But I'm thrilled that they're there, and I think, even though I'm not always watching them come out, what gives me the greatest pleasure is just knowing that they're there, knowing they've got the habitat that we've provided.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kim in Arena has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kim. Thanks for calling.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for taking my call. My husband and I are big lovers of bats, and we live on the Wisconsin River, very near Spring Green. And we have a pond even closer to us than the river, and the river's only about 100 yards away. So we traditionally have lots of bats, but not necessarily where we want them. About 5 years ago, we had to hire someone to come to our cabin and humanely remove them from the top of our screened-in porch. There was, it was kind of like a sci-fi movie. There was so many of them. And then during, White Nose?
Yeah.
We went down to literally no bats, and I was heartbroken. But now they're back. But unfortunately, they're going back up on that screen again above the screened-in porch, and we just can't afford to have them humanely removed again. So I'm just looking for some. We have bat boxes up. They seem to prefer the attachment to the house. Very small cabin.
Hmm. Well, sure. What do you go ahead, Paul?
Well, we've seen a lot of different techniques on trying to get bats out of attics and out of these spaces, and it's from blaring music to mothballs to leaving the lights on to, you're on the gamut. As long as they have a way into the structure, they will find their way in. They certainly won't chew their way in, but they will exploit any opening that's available. To me, for this instance, it actually sounds like they might be roosting on the outside of the building. If you're interested, maybe putting up a bat house right next to the area where they're accumulating might be helpful, although then you've got them, in a box still on the side of your building. But putting those bat houses as close to where they're at as possible and discouraging them from going in there. Again, if they're getting into the home, then that's the way that you need to go about addressing that, is finding all the entry points. You're excluding them, which means you're putting up like a one-way door, which allows them to leave and not come back in. And you do that before May 31st and then after August 15th. And this is to ensure that if there are pups during the June 1st through August 15th time period, that you won't accidentally leave them inside. So, you're welcome to obviously call us after this, and we can discuss more options. But really, again, that's the primary focus, is trying to minimize them getting into the home. So,
yeah. And if they're, and these are on a porch, which is the porch open, Kim?
It is for the summertime. It's screened in, but we have panels that we put up in the wintertime. But we did have a gentleman come out, like I say, about 5 years ago. He was wonderful. He put little circular tubes where there were entry points so that the bats could go in they would come out. He sat and watched to see where they would come out at night. And then he put these circular tubes in, and he said that bats don't have a very good sense of smell. So this would deter the bats from going back in. He wanted them all to come out, which they did, but then he'd put these tubes in, and it would deter them from going back into that hole because he said they don't see well and they don't smell well. So, yeah, I know, it's pretty confusing, and I just want to get this, because we made it through the summer last year, even though they were coming in on the porch, and every time I took the garbage out, it was like, okay, who's coming at me now?
I do. I've got 3 other maybe suggestions for you, Kim. A couple of things. Bats are wanting warm, dry conditions, like we talked about earlier with the bat houses. So if you can make the porch area where they're roosting a little more unpleasant for them, if there's a way to create some air movement, even early in spring and summer as the bats are starting to arrive back, like putting a fan nearby and running that during both daytime and night, depending on when you're seeing them. And also, I've heard of folks hanging, you know, like those garden predator owls under their overhangs, and that, in a couple of cases, anecdotally, I've heard has worked, at least temporarily. And then, you know, you can always, depending on where they're at, create a capture system for the guano, because it's obviously, in many cases, people don't want the bat droppings, the guano falling onto their porch or their front steps. So you can always create kind of a catchment system that would go beneath where the bats are roosting and try to collect some of that. And then it's great garden fertilizer. So you've got both things going on there.
Kim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Steve in Verona will give you a chance. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry, Paul, and Jennifer. We have a single bat hibernating in a space, and he's under the shingles and flashing next to the chimney. We're about to repair the area. How long should we wait before asking our guest to leave? It's a little chilly right now, and I would feel badly sending him on his way. We do have a bat box nearby, but he doesn't have directions to it.
Well, you know, the good news, Steve, is that it's probably a big brown bat, because that's the species we usually see in homes occasionally over winter, whether it's someone's attic or the wall or, you know, a basement even. And luckily, big brown bats are fairly hardy, and they emerge on the landscape quite early in spring. In fact, we, you know, occasionally see them flying around even in midwinter because, you know, maybe they do decide to leave someone's home where they've been hibernating. So starting next week, if you look for a night when the nighttime temperatures are going to be above 50 degrees, you know, that evening or afternoon would be a good time to help the bat move along. And of course, we never recommend that anyone handle a bat. If you do need to do so, you can use, you know, a piece of cardboard or a cardboard box and try to get them outdoors or to another place where they can safely perhaps crawl up a tree or be on a branch up high off the ground and make their own way from there.
Yeah, I think it's going to be somewhere around close to 70 degrees on Saturday in southern Wisconsin, so that might be a good time, Steve. thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Lynn in Coon Valley next. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Great show. I am aware that bats eat mosquitoes, but do they also eat Asian ladybugs and Japanese beetles?
So they do, in fact, eat mosquitoes. In Wisconsin, we work with the UW-Madison and looked at their guano and noticed 17 different types of mosquitoes, including 9 that were known to carry West Nile virus. So that was good. I don't know about the other two. I think the issue often becomes whether you see them during the day and whether they're active at night. And so I'm unsure about those two. Insect species.
Yeah, and those insect species aren't very active at night, I don't think. And so that would be an issue because aren't they typically, I mean, they're picking the insects off in the air using some sort of echolocation thing, aren't they, Jennifer?
Right.
Or Paul, yeah. So
yes, they are. Yeah, for the most part, they are. And there are some species that can glean or eat insects off of foliage and even spiders from webs. And that's primarily the northern long-eared bat. But if they're settling into a spot that's difficult to get to, then bats aren't really going after those types of insects.
Mm. There you go, Lynn. Thank you for calling. Joe in Duluth, Minnesota. On to you. Hi, Joe.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, on my mind, more opinions and listening to your guests, my opinion and my thought was I had bats in my cabin, and they were roosting up there, and I wasn't happy. I had all their feces in my attic. I had all their urine was staining the side of my cedar cabin, and I was told how unhealthy they were, because they carried rabies, and they really don't eat that many mosquitoes, and I never noticed anything that showed me there were fewer mosquitoes. So to the lady that's having a problem, I had an exterminator come, and he set up one-way traps so that humanely the bats were all gone, and then he filled all the openings. They can get through tiny, tiny holes, and except for an occasional bat behind my shutters, I haven't experienced them in a while.
And, you know, a bat can, you know, fit through a hole, what, the size of a dime, maybe? I mean, they can get through a pretty small hole, if I'm not mistaken, Jennifer.
Yeah, they can really exploit small spaces. And, you know, we certainly wouldn't expect folks to have bats residing in their living space or causing damage through urine staining and guano buildup. And so hiring a bat exclusion specialist who will perform that work outside of the maternity season, so in the fall and winter, that's the time when we want to see that type of exclusion done where they're coming and sealing up the holes.
Mm-hmm. Joe, thanks. Gianni in Montello, we'll go to you next. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, great topic. Listen, two questions. Bat guano, can one contract rabies if inhaling bat guano where rabid bats are present? And number two, in Wisconsin, not too much spelunking going around here, but in Wisconsin, what is there any studies of how many, what percentage of our bat populations could be infected with rabies? Any studies in that area?
Yeah, let's hear from Paul on that. Paul?
Sure. So when I think of guano, I don't think of rabies. I think of a disease called histoplasmosis, and that can happen with bird or bat guano in areas that is warm and wet. And so that is a disease that causes a respiratory infection. It's rarely fatal if untreated, and it often just presents itself like flu-like symptoms. And so these are areas where you might have a large accumulation of guano and there isn't any air movement through there. And again, if you're going into an attic space that might have guano in it, then it would be a good idea to wear a mask and then you can clean that up. Usually we recommend spraying a water over the top of it, just a fine mist of water as you're cleaning it up to reduce any aerosolization, and then you can clean it up with a 10% bleach solution. I haven't heard of folks contracting rabies from bat guano. It's typically direct contact either through exchange of saliva or obviously a bite or a scratch. With regards to how much, or you know, what's the prevalence in Wisconsin? Well, I know in the wild population, 99% of the wild population do not have rabies. So it's the very low percentage of wild bats that actually have rabies. And we are privy to the information that folks from the Wisconsin they submit bats for rabies testing every year, the State Lab of Hygiene. And so of those bats, we see typically around 3 to 5% of those bats that are rabid. But these, again, are bats that are acting a little out of the ordinary. They're approachable. They might be on the ground. And so in that case, we would actually expect a little bit higher of a rabies incident level. But typically, it's a very, very low percentage of bats that actually have rabies.
All right. There you go. Thanks very much for calling. Well, the bats are coming out. And Jennifer, you might see some bats or a bat on the ground. And not necessarily mean that it has rabies. It might be just a young bat, right?
That's right. You know, there are a few different times where we start to get a lot of calls from people observing bats in somewhat unusual or unexpected places. So right now, as bats are emerging from their hibernating places onto the landscape, you know, they still may be moving slowly because the weather is cold. So whether or not that's finding a bat during the day or early in the morning, they may be roosting on the side of a building, the side of a tree. They may be on the ground. Certainly, the best policy is, you know, if you care, leave them there. You know, let nature take its course, and as long as the bat is not in harm's way, leave it alone for it to make its own way. But later in the summer, usually in mid-July to late July, we also receive calls from the public who are noticing the young of the year, the pups that are just learning to fly, and they're sometimes roosting in unusual locations, again, on a building or low down on a tree or perhaps on the ground. And then even again in fall, as bats are migrating back to their hibernation sites, similar to this time of the year, they're on the move on the landscape. And so they're not at their normal bat house. They're not at their normal cave. And so they're having to find sheltered locations for roosting during the day as they move between those two habitats.
And I did, and I think Paul mentioned in terms of excluding bats and so forth, and there's timing on that of when, you know, if they're in your home. And maybe that's worth repeating because there are some rules and regulations regarding that, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. So all of our cave bats, because of the threat of white nose syndrome, are considered state threatened in the state. In the process, they have protections, and one of those protections is to not exclude bats during the time in which they might have flightless pups. So it takes anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks for pups to begin and learn how to fly, and so at that time, it can be very vulnerable for the mothers to be excluded, and then the pups cannot get out of those spaces. And so from June 1st through August 15th, there shouldn't be any exclusion or bat exclusion going on without folks filling out a cave bat health exemption form, which is readily available on our website if they've deemed a health concern there. But typically, you're allowed to exclude, you know, there's the exclusion period runs right up to May 31st, and then after August 16th, you're allowed to exclude without any kind of additional form that needs to be filled out.
So you've got a pretty wide window there to work with, for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, the best course of action: find out all the holes that are in your structure, which can be daunting for an older home. But put up these bat valves or exclusion devices at all of these places. Typically, leave them up for 7 to 10 days with good weather above 50 degrees. And after that point, then you seal everything up using the appropriate construction materials so that the bats can't get back in. Again, they're not going to chew their way in, but they will exploit any opening that's left open.
And Jennifer, as well, talk about the information. You have a lot of really good information about bats on your website.
Yeah, if folks visit the DNR website and just type bats into the search field there, you can get information directly from the DNR website, or you can link to our external citizen-based monitoring website where we have resources about, you know, the various species we have in the state, how to, you know, pamphlets about how to exclude bats from homes and buildings, as Paul mentioned earlier, how to build a bat house and where to place it. We have a packet on that. And then also, if you're interested in monitoring an existing bat colony, if you have bats and enjoy having them there and appreciate their benefits, you can help us by counting the bats as they emerge on a summer evening and then entering that information on our website. We would really appreciate having that because we can't be everywhere every night, and we really rely on the public to be the eyes on the nighttime skies for Wisconsin.
Yeah. And that DNR website is great. I love it. It's a fun and interesting place to go. And you two are pretty interesting and fun too, Paul and Jennifer. Thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we can do this again. Thank you,
Larry.
Yeah, thank you, Larry.
Paul White, conservation biologist, and Jennifer Riddell, a conservation biologist and a cave mine specialist as well, both, of course, with our Wisconsin DNR. They'll be back. We'll talk with them again. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at vehicle maintenance at this time of the year. Those April showers, they can bring some flooded roads, and that's something to deal with. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.